Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present journalist Catherine Cartier, who talks about her recent Intercept investigation into Israel's new air war in the West Bank that's killed an increasing number of Palestinian children. Emily Sanders, a reporter with Exxon News, who discusses her recent article, Big Oil Wants to Increase Federal Criminal Penalties for Pipeline Protests, Further Criminalizing Activists, Organizing to Address the Climate Crisis. And John Bonifaz, co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People, who examines the U.S. Supreme Court's many scandals and discusses his group's campaign, demanding accountability to restore integrity. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
It's been more than 3 years since Myanmar's army staged a coup, seizing power from the elected government of civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who has since been tried in a secret military court and jailed. The overthrow of the government led to mass protests that have since evolved into an armed rebellion after the military responded with force. More than 5,000 civilians have been killed since the coup, and more than 20,500 are imprisoned. Although the army has attempted to bolster its forces with thousands of Rohingya men kidnapped from crowded refugee camps in Bangladesh, the civil war is not going well for the generals, who have been accused of war crimes. According to the International Crisis Group at the end of October last year, Myanmar's military regime has lost control of more regions of the Southeast Asian country, particularly along its borders, since anti-coup forces formed an alliance between ethnic rebels and pro-democracy forces to mount a renewed offensive. Meanwhile, there's a call for humanitarian aid for civilians, as 3 million people have fled their homes due to fighting. Five of the world's largest banks are greenwashing their role in the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. According to a report by the watchdog group Stand.Earth and the coordinating body of indigenous organizations of the Amazon Basin, big banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, and Bank of America, promote environmental guidelines that failed to protect over two-thirds of the Amazon. According to The Guardian, these banks are providing billions of dollars in financing of oil and gas companies involved in projects that are impacting the Amazon or impinging on the land and livelihoods of indigenous peoples. For example, J.P. Morgan's biodiversity policy only covers UNESCO heritage sites, covering 2% of the Amazon, sites that are not likely to be considered for oil or gas exploration. On the positive side, the British bank HSBC formerly funded major Amazon energy projects, but has not provided any fossil fuel financing since December 2022. Fanny Kuriv, coordinator of the Alliance of Amazon Indigenous Groups, said, "The banks try to wash their hands of the blame through vague policies, but must be held accountable for the damage their money is causing to the rainforest." From 1819 until 1969, tens of thousands of Native American children in North America were forced or coerced from their homes and sent to Indian boarding schools, the majority run and funded by the U.S. government. Of more than 500 schools, 84 were operated by the Catholic Church or its religious affiliates. A Washington Post investigation published in May found that at least 122 priests, sisters, and brothers were assigned to 22 Indian schools during this era, and who were later accused of sexually abusing Native American children under their care. While Pope Francis apologized to the First Nations for the rampant abuse uncovered in Canada, the Pope and Catholic institutions in the U.S. have been largely silent about exposing abuses by members of the Church. But on June 14th, the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Conference issued a formal apology for the church's role in inflicting a history of trauma on Native Americans. However, the bishop's 56-page statement did not specifically mention nor acknowledge the sexual abuse that took place at their Indian schools. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Israel's brutal war in Gaza continues as ceasefire talks have stalled, and the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees announced that more than 50,000 children in Gaza require immediate medical treatment for acute malnutrition. On June 17th, Gaza's health ministry reported that more than 37,347 Palestinians have been killed and more than 85,000 have been injured since Israel's offensive began on October 7th. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu disbanded his six-member war cabinet after a key opposition party member resigned. But as the world is understandably focused on the ongoing horrific carnage in Gaza, Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank are suffering an explosion of violence. Since the war in Gaza started, Israeli military raids and settler attacks in the West Bank have resulted in the deaths of 521 Palestinians, including 126 children, as of June 10th. As Israel's government announced plans to expand illegal Jewish settlements across the West Bank, Israeli settlers continued their attacks and takeover of Palestinian homes and land. Your reporter spoke with Catherine Cartier, a journalist who's pursuing an MA in Global Journalism and Near Eastern Studies at New York University. Here she talks about her recent Intercept investigation titled Israel's New Air War in the West Bank, Nearly Half the Dead Are Children, that details the rising number of Palestinian civilians being killed by Israeli airstrikes and drone attacks that were last seen in the occupied territory more than 20 years ago.
I think the numbers paint a pretty stark picture about what's going on the ground in the West Bank. And 2023 was the deadliest year that the UN has on record since they started collecting statistics for Palestinians in the West Bank. Israeli soldiers, as well as settlers there, who are often backed and offered protection by soldiers, killed 506 Palestinians. And it was also the deadliest year on record for children, with more than three times as many children killed in 2023 as were in 2022. And that is also coming, you know, within a broader picture of daily raids by the Israeli military into the West Bank and ongoing attacks by settlers. According to an NGO, B'Tselem, settlers have forcibly displaced almost 20 Palestinian communities since October 7th, 2023 alone. So the air attacks that I looked at in my article are just one very small piece of that escalating and intensifying violence in the West Bank.
Catherine, please summarize what you found in your investigation into Israel's airstrikes in the West Bank and the rising number of Palestinian children that are being killed there, both before and after the Hamas October 7th attack, and the reintroduction of West Bank air attacks 20 years after the Second Intifada was over, and that took place, as you said in the article, from 2000 to 2005.
So according to the UN, Israeli air attacks in the West Bank have killed 55 people. What our investigation with The Intercept found is that the attacks have killed 24 children, making up over 40% of the fatalities. And that's based on publicly available information, as well as affidavits from an NGO on the ground that interviews eyewitnesses called Defense for Children International Palestine. The reintroduction of these air attacks predates the October 7th attacks. The first attack documented in many, many years was in June of last year, and the attacks have intensified after October 7th, but they did not begin with October 7th. And as you mentioned, so the IDF previously used air power in the West Bank during the Second Intifada. That was mainly helicopters, but there are eyewitness reports of drone attacks in Jenin as early as 2004. But this is a significant, you know, this is an almost 20-year period in which the use of helicopters, of air-powered explosives, and of drones was not happening or was extremely, extremely rare in the West Bank.
Catherine, you describe in some harrowing detail some of these attacks conducted by Israel with drones in the West Bank. And in particular, you described some incidents in Jenin and Balada where children were killed as a result of these Israeli airstrikes. Can you describe some of these incidents that resulted in the death of innocents, people who had nothing to do with whatever Israel was conducting a raid for?
Yeah, so I'll describe a couple attacks in which Israeli air attacks killed unarmed children who were not participating in hostilities. One of these happened in February of this year in Jenin. A child was standing in a street when someone who had been described as wanted by the Israeli Defense Force was targeted in a drone attack. That child, whose name was Saeed Jaradat, suffered fatal injuries, and he passed away shortly after the attack. Similar incident happened outside of Jenin in January of this year. A 17-year-old was killed by a drone-fired missile. Israeli forces were withdrawing after a raid. They were confronted. This is based on evidence from Defense for Children International Palestine. They were confronted with a group of Palestinians with explosives. And after Israeli vehicles had left the area, a drone fired on a different group of Palestinians, including this 17-year-old who was standing around a fire at an all-night cafe. That attack killed seven Palestinians, including four brothers. And there's similar incidences that have taken place in Tulkarm and Nur Shems refugee camp, as well as in Balada refugee camp, which is near Nablus.
Catherine, tell us about what international law and the Geneva Convention says about this type of military raid in the West Bank, in occupied territory, illegally occupied by Israel, as well as what the Israeli courts are saying about these raids and the deaths caused by these aerial attacks in particular.
Because of the West Bank's status, there is the Israeli position, and then there are different positions from international law experts who I spoke to during my reporting. Israel's position here is that, which is based on a Supreme Court ruling in 2006, is that the law of armed conflict is what governs Israel's tactics in the West Bank, the Geneva Conventions being part of the laws of armed conflict. However, the experts that I spoke to believe that international human rights law applies. So in this view, this casts Israeli forces more in the role of law enforcement officers rather than combatants in a war, and the use of force would only be allowable as a last resort to protect the life of an officer or others from immediate injury or death, whereas the law of armed conflict is more permissive in terms of the use of force and the use of lethal force.
That was Catherine Cartier, a journalist who's pursuing an MA in Global Journalism and Near Eastern Studies at New York University. Find a link to her Intercept article titled Israel's New Air War in the West Bank, Nearly Half the Dead Are Children, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent years, many states have passed what they call critical infrastructure laws, which criminalize protests against fossil fuel projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline, where 800 protesters were criminally charged. New federal legislation is now being considered that would add vaguely worded elements to the reauthorization bill for the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, that could put protesters at risk for prosecution on federal charges and threaten freedom of the press. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Emily Sanders, senior reporter with Exxon News, a reporting and analysis project of the Center for Climate Integrity, which supports communities working to hold the oil and gas industry accountable for its deceptions. Sanders' recent article, titled Big Oil Wants to Increase Federal Criminal Penalties for Pipeline Protests, documents how fossil fuel companies and allied trade groups are using pipeline safety legislation to further criminalize activists organizing to address the climate crisis. Here she describes the threats posed by this legislation.
I started reporting on this a few months ago because I was looking at the pipeline safety reauthorization negotiations that were going on in Congress, which started in the wake of a really disastrous carbon capture pipeline rupture in Satartia, Mississippi, that sent nearly 50 people to the hospital and stalled emergency response vehicles, just created a huge disaster there. And people realized in the wake of that, that carbon capture and carbon dioxide pipelines were so not very well understood. And the safety requirements needed to protect communities were not very well understood. So advocates began pushing for new safety rules. And the industry, as I found out back in April, has been lobbying and pushing to limit those safety rules and dictate as many safety standards as they can on their own. And while I was reporting that story, I started finding policy briefs and hearing testimony and lobbying records, which all indicated that the industry has been encouraging Congress to add additional broader language that would expand the definition of a pipeline protest that's punishable under existing federal law and the penalties for such protests. So even though it's already illegal to damage or destroy a pipeline under federal law, according to one policy brief by the American Petroleum Institute on pipeline safety reauthorization legislative priorities published last year, new pipeline legislation should, quote, fill the gaps in current law with additional measures covering disruption of service and attacks on construction sites, unquote. Of course, that is very vague language. Nobody really knows what an attack on a construction site could entail, what disruption of service could entail. And this really has the power to tamp down and to silence protesters who oppose the fossil fuel industry's build out of infrastructure, and in particular, infrastructure that threatens the planet, threatens the climate, and threatens communities. Right now, there are two bills being considered in the House. There's the Energy and Commerce Committee's bill, and then there's the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee's bill. Congress has to reconcile those two bills, and then it goes over to the Senate. What I found was that these vague measures to criminalize protest of pipelines started showing up in the House Energy and Commerce Committee's draft bill. You know, the bill says it would add, quote, impairing the operation of interstate pipelines, quote, damaging or destroying such a facility under construction, and even attempting or conspiring to do so as felony activities that could be punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Again, we don't know what impairing the operation of a pipeline really means. If interpreted broadly, there's a whole set of constitutionally protected protest activities that could be implicated by this. It's not just locking yourself to pipeline equipment. Pipeline protests can also be sit-ins at a construction site. They can be a march, planting sacred corn in the pathway of a pipeline, as they did during the Keystone XL protests. We know how concerning this is because other similar laws have been passed, as you mentioned, at the state level to crack down on protests, and those have perpetuated mass waves of arrests.
Is this just getting out there due to your reporting, or is this something that other people closer to it on the ground know about? And are you aware of any efforts to, you know, expose this or turn this back, this kind of vague wording that could be included in the reauthorization?
I know that there are groups that are generally fighting the broader effort to criminalize protest and criminalize protest of fossil fuel infrastructure. And there are groups that can provide free or pro bono legal defense to people who need help, whose First Amendment rights have been trampled on. The Climate Defense Project is really good for that. The Center for Constitutional Rights as well. But ultimately, I think the theme I kept hearing from advocates is that the industry wouldn't be trying so hard to silence its opposition if it wasn't seriously threatened by it.
That was Emily Sanders, senior reporter with Exxon News, KNEWS. Find a link to her recent article titled Big Oil wants to increase federal criminal penalties for pipeline protests and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the last several years, the U.S. Supreme Court has suffered multiple scandals and issued a slew of widely unpopular rulings that have contributed to a loss of public confidence in the nation's highest court. ProPublica conducted a series of investigations detailing how extremist right-wing Justice Clarence Thomas has received millions of dollars worth of gifts from wealthy benefactors, including all-expense-paid luxury vacations, paid school tuition, and the purchase of his mother's house, all of which he failed to disclose, in violation of federal law. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have called for an investigation of Justice Samuel Alito, following revelations that he's flown insurrectionist flags outside two of his homes, and the disclosure of recent covert recordings of his comments, agreeing that the U.S. is locked in a culture war between liberals and conservatives, and that there are some differences on fundamental issues that can't be compromised. Amid the Supreme Court's rejection of an ethics code with a mechanism for accountability, the court's six-member extremist supermajority have overturned decades of precedents that protected women's reproductive rights, opened the door to racial and LGBTQ discrimination, embraced discriminatory voter suppression laws, favored corporate interests over the public interest, and issued decisions prioritizing the rights of Christian nationalists over the rest of the nation. Your reporter spoke with John Bonifaz, a constitutional attorney and the co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People. Here he talks about his group's recently launched Supreme Court Reform Now campaign, demanding accountability to restore the high court's integrity.
It's really quite incredible the level of corruption that exists among certain justices. You have Justice Clarence Thomas, who has received gifts, huge sums of gifts and vacation gifts and an RV and so forth, much of which he never disclosed, from a billionaire, right-wing billionaire named Harlan Crow. And that person happens to have a lot of business before the U.S. Supreme Court. So he has been already influenced by Harlan Crow and failed to disclose all these gifts. You know, as Congressman Jamie Raskin and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently highlighted in a hearing they held, there's a $50 gift ban for members of Congress. They can't take more than $50 from an individual without it being disclosed, and even after that, it's actual banned, anything above that. And yet here you have effectively hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, flowing in terms of gifts to Justice Clarence Thomas. And only because of reporting by ProPublica did it get exposed. And, of course, Clarence Thomas tries to argue that there was nothing wrong with any of these gifts and that he's not going to recuse himself from any of the cases that his billionaire investor, Harlan Crow, has in the Supreme Court. Then you have similar kinds of gifts that Justice Alito has received, even Justice Gorsuch has received. And separate from that, of course, is a scandal of both Justices Thomas and Justice Alito showing clear bias with respect to matters dealing with the January 6th insurrection. Justice Thomas's wife was directly involved in the Stop the Steal movement trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. And Justice Alito, as we now know, has had insurrectionist flags flying outside his properties, both in Alexandria, Virginia, as well as his beach home in New Jersey. And in both instances, you know, he has claimed somehow that it was his wife that flew these flags and he couldn't get them down and he tried to get them down. But the point here is that he has an apparent bias, at least from the looks of it, clear appearance of bias, and he won't recuse himself from the cases that are pending before the court dealing with the January 6th insurrection, including a case as whether or not Donald Trump has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for his role in trying to overturn the 2020 election, which Jack Smith is currently leading a special counsel of the Department of Justice, and neither will Justice Thomas recuse himself, despite his wife's direct involvement in the effort to overturn the 2020 election.
John, please review for our audience the elements of your group's Supreme Court Reform Now campaign, as well as how this issue of the Supreme Court should be handled in the critical 2024 election campaign, where Joe Biden just said during a campaign fundraiser recently that surely the next president, and if it's Trump, he will be able to select two more Supreme Court justices in the mold of the most extremists on the court that he's already put on there, three of them.
I think voters care about a lot of issues, and they ought to also care about the Supreme Court. The four prongs that we have of SCOTUS Reform Now are, number one, investigate the corruption. We're demanding that the Senate Judiciary Committee subpoena the right-wing billionaire Harlan Crow and enforce the existing subpoena against Leonard Leo of the Federal Society. A full investigation of the corruption of the Supreme Court is necessary. And that now includes an investigation of these insurrectionist flags flying outside Justice Alito's homes. Number two, we need to hold the justices accountable, and we are urging impeachment proceedings. The House Judiciary Committee to initiate impeachment proceedings against Justice Thomas for alleged abuses of power, Justice Kavanaugh regarding the sexual misconduct allegations, perjury, and conspiracy to obstruct congressional proceedings, and now Justice Alito for his misconduct and his refusal to recuse from these critical cases. And then number three, expand the court to restore balance and ensure the rights of the American people. Congress should pass the Judiciary Act, which adds four seats to the Supreme Court. There's nothing in the Constitution that says there need to be nine justices. It used to be that we had six. And there's a clear argument based on the expansion of the judiciary that four new seats should be added. And then finally, number four, enforce ethical standards. Congress must pass the Supreme Court Ethics, Recusal, and Transparency Act and the Judicial Ethics Enforcement Act of 2024. These bills would establish a code of conduct for justices, improve disclosure, create an Office of Inspector General, and ban substantial gifts to justices. All of this is necessary to restore the court's balance and legitimacy.
That was John Bonifaz, co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People. Learn more about the group's Supreme Court Reform Now campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.